For decades, a mystery has haunted Tamworth.
Mark Anthony Haynes' body was discovered on an isolated stretch of train tracks.
No one talked about him. He was just another little black fella.
An ABC True Crime podcast was followed by a fresh inquest.
Someone's just holding their breath.
If he didn't do it directly, he knows what happened.
With the truth closer than ever, hear the whole story now. Search for Unravel Blood on the Tracks. It's on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
From Wurundjeri Country, I'm Luke Sidham-Dundon, and today on The Breakfast Wrap, you're going to hear all about a shutdown of Tasmania's rock lobster fishing industry over concerns coming from China. That is coming up later on, but we're going to do something a little different today and leave that there and make space for an extended interview discussing a pretty significant political story. There's new polling from the Australian Financial Review, Redbridge and Accent Research Group, that suggests One Nation is more trusted to handle migration than Labor or the Coalition. So today, on The Breakfast Wrap, you're going to hear a comprehensive interview with One Nation leader Pauline Hanson. The numbers are a boost for the party, which has been climbing in the polls and courting former Nationals leader and ex-Deputy Prime Minister turned backbencher Barnaby Joyce. Tony Barry is a former Victorian Liberal Party director and strategist. He's now the director of the Redbridge Research and Strategy firm, and he shared some detail on the numbers with Sally.
Yeah, look, the Liberal Party have been bleeding votes to the right flank, and that they've been going to One Nation. The concern for the Liberal Party in the last poll that was published by the Fin Review yesterday is that they've now started bleeding votes to Labor as well. So Labor's primary went up a few points, as did One Nation's. And the coalition vote is now at record lows of 24%. As we've seen from history, Labor can win government with a primary vote in the low 30s. The coalition can't do the same. Their whole economic model is built on a primary vote of around 45%. I think John Howard won in 1998 with a 39% primary. That was that election where there was a surge of One Nation votes, and most of those flowed back. So there was a bit of a preference flow there. The coalition are 24%. So they are realistically 21 points away from where they need to be on a primary vote basis. And look, you know, policies like net zero, immigration, there might be some points on the table there, primary votes on the table there. There is a concern, as Penny Wong, articulated the other day, that you can't out Hanson Hanson. So will they win back all those votes? Probably not. So, even accounting for some growth in primary on the net zero policy, an immigration policy that cuts numbers might also see a growth in primary, but I don't think there's 21 points on the table on those two issues alone.
Redbridge pollster and ex-Liberal Party strategist Tony Barry there. So as the coalition turns from net zero to now focusing on immigration, these polling figures are a good sign for One Nation. Pauline Hanson came on this morning for an extended interview with Sally Sara to face questions about her immigration policies, her rhetoric as a national figure, and her views on the latest coalition policy.
First up, do you welcome the coalition's decision to dump net zero by 2050?
Of course I do, but they haven't gone far enough. They should be getting out of the Paris Agreement because you can't have one without the other.
On the weekend, we heard from Foreign Minister Senator Penny Wong, and she said that the coalition is trying to, in her words, out Pauline Pauline. What do you think?
Well, really, I'd like a bit more of a please explain to that one anyway. But, One Nation, we've been setting the agenda for many years now to do with mass migration, to do with, climate change, with The Voice. Everything that we've set in place, the coalition have followed our lead on this. So this is just another one. The coalition doesn't know where they are. They're not even in sync with their own counterparts in the states because the states are glued to net zero. So what is the federal going to do about it when the states don't follow their lead? They are in such disarray.
What do you think are the chances of the coalition being able to gather support from more voters, particularly on the right wing? Are you worried that you might lose some support?
Look, I think that the people realise now that I've been consistent with policies, and these things I will see through and will follow through with it if we're in a position to hold the balance power or opposition or eventually government in this country. So it's coming from the general public. They don't trust the major political parties anymore. That's why they're turning to One Nation.
But the major parties still have far more support than One Nation, don't they?
Well, you know, if you have a look at where the polling is showing now, and of course it's only just polling, and it shows that One Nation is gathering more and more support because the clear-cut policies that we are putting out there, it's not about politicians sitting on the fence and just doing what's good for them to keep their jobs. It's about representing the people.
Is it simply this move away from the major parties? Is that simply reflecting dissatisfaction with the major parties as opposed to specific support for you? Because we've also seen support for independents and Teals on the other side of the electoral spectrum.
It is a bit of both, Sally, because in the last election you got about 35 to 40% of people who don't want to vote for the major political parties anymore. They are actually not turning to them anymore. They don't like their policies. They don't like the direction the country is going. Because we've been around, One Nation now has been around for about 28, 29 years, that's why people see the consistency. That's why we got three members, senators elected at the last election. We increased in our vote even at the last election. We've increased our vote from 6.4% now to 18%, although it's only a poll that's been taken, but it's a clear indication. We have that indication by the membership that has grown. You know, we were signing up a member there last weekend every 29 seconds. They were signing up a member to the party. I go out amongst the public or I go to meetings, that type of thing. I'm just, you know, the number of people that come up to me and wish us all the best, and people that say now, I voted Liberal or I voted Labor all my life. No more. I've had enough of them. I'm actually going to vote for One Nation, come across One Nation. And a lot of these people also are migrants, have come to this country, see the mess that we're headed in. They said, we came here for a new way of life. We can see Australia heading down the same path. It's what happened to our country. We don't want it to happen here.
But on things like net zero, for example, the government, the Labor government, ran on a policy of sticking with net zero. They were returned with a big margin, weren't they? So there's a big significant portion of the population that's with that stance.
No, sorry, you're wrong there, because you see, although they won the number of seats, but because of our voting system, the preference system, that's why they won the number of seats. But you don't have a mandate.
But that's the system we have. That's how we measure it.
You don't have a mandate on 35% of the vote, when it's clearly 65% of the public didn't vote for them. It's a system that we have, but it doesn't give them a clear mandate and to actually go out and do what they do. This net zero, the policies that they have, is going to cost us $8 trillion. Where's the money going to come from, Sally? Unless we turn it around.
Where do you get the figure of $8 trillion from?
It's been complete. A lot of reports have been written. If you don't understand that, you have not been kept up to date with what this is going to be going to cost the country to roll this out.
This $8 or $9 trillion dollar figure, the actual number has been much less. The organisation that put out those figures, that's been quoted with those figures, says that it's been misrepresented. That the figure is much, much lower. So where's the eight come from?
Sally, I have read this on a few occasions. I put it in my own press releases and I have not been pulled up with this at all in the past. I haven't got that organisation at hand at the moment.
That's Net Zero Australia. It said $9 trillion is misquoting the report. Different individuals and groups have been misrepresenting key cost estimates from the project. This is Net Zero Australia. The cost of reaching net zero by 2050 is closer to $300 billion, not $9 trillion or $8 trillion.
Sally, I totally disagree with you, because the 10,000 kilometres or 20,000 kilometres of transmission lines that they want to put in, so it's constantly, if you think it's going to cost only $300 billion, you're misleading the public as well.
Let's move on to immigration. This week, polling published in the Australian Financial Review shows your party is more trusted than Labor or the Coalition to deal with the arrival of migrants. What are the principles of your policy? What would you do?
The principles are that we need to cut it right back to around about 130,000 a year. I'm not saying no migrants. We need to actually allow for migrants to come into the country. excuse me, we have about up to 200,000 people that leave the country, so you can replace those. We have skills and services that we definitely need in Australia. By all means, bring in those migrants. But until we iron it out, in September 25 this year, we had the highest intake of nearly 36,000 migrants in 1 month, the highest since September 23 on record. Sally, on record. Now, when I have people that are ringing up my office complaining they can't get housing, they can't afford housing, they can't get rent, you do not keep flooding the country with migrants into the country. And don't tell me that they are skilled migrants. In 22-23, we have 740,000 came into the country. Of that, only 51,605 actually were skilled migrants, and of that, only 1,800 in the construction industry.
The measure that's most commonly used is net overseas migration. By the end of 2024, net migration had fallen to 340,750, and it's projected to fall to 255,000 this year. So the number of migrants currently in Australia as a proportion of the population is broadly where it was before the pandemic, wasn't it?
We were bringing in under the coalition government before the Morrison, under the Morrison government, was around about 260,000 a year. They dropped it to 190,000 because at that time there was even too many migrants coming in. And the fact is that this government ramped it right up and they've had it up high. As I said to you, we've just had the highest intake of any month on record, which was September of this year. Nearly 36,000.
But the overall figures for the year are projected to fall this year, aren't they?
Sally, the fact is that we have people who cannot get accommodation, can't get housing. We've got the homeless. I don't care about these people coming in from overseas wanting a new life in Australia. I care about the people that are here in Australia who can't get a house. We've seen the increase of the cost of housing. How can future generations or even these people now afford a house? They cannot get into the housing market. That's my responsibility, is to the people here, not worry about migrants coming into the country because the government wants to prop up their GDP.
Have you had any further conversations with backbencher and former Nationals leader Barnaby Joyce on whether he'll make the move to One Nation, or conversations with anyone else from the coalition along those lines?
No, actually, I haven't. I was over in America for the last couple of weeks. I've got my trial on at the moment. I will be heading to Canberra next week, so I hope to catch up with Barnaby next week, and I intend to cook him dinner and have a good chat with him.
What's going to be on the agenda?
Well, I'm going to have a good talk with him about whether his prospects will be better with One Nation, because with the National Party, I'm about 4 or 5% at the moment. I think 18% looks a lot more healthy to him.
So if you're cooking him dinner, it sounds like you want him on board.
Of course I want him on board. I won't deny that. And I've said that all along.
On the issue of neo-Nazis, do you agree with Home Affairs Minister Tony Burke's decision to cancel the visa of a South African man who attended a neo-Nazi rally outside the New South Wales Parliament?
I don't know a lot about that or his history of this. Like I said, I've been out of the country, I've been tied up with it. I've only sort of seen briefly to make a comment about it. No, we don't need neo-Nazis in the country, and I totally oppose them. And I supported the bill on the floor of Parliament with the government to actually oppose it. But if he's going to do that, I wish he'd actually oppose terrorists from terrorist organisations and those ones with the hate speech allowed in the country as well. If you're going to do it for one, do it right across the board.
Should neo-Nazis have space to stage public rallies in Australia, in your view?
Look, we have hate laws. If they come under the hate laws, well, then they shouldn't be allowed to do it, regardless of whether neo-Nazis or whether they're from different religions or different cultural backgrounds are spreading the hate on their streets. We don't want it here, either one. We don't want these people here. I think it's we don't need to stir up division in the country. And I'm concerned neo-Nazis are going after the Jewish community, which we've seen happen. I think it's disgraceful. People have a right to live in peace and feel safe in this country. But when you've got anyone spewing the hate on the streets, and I've seen that not only from neo-Nazis, I've seen it from some clerics on our streets, and I think it's disgusting, yet we don't seem to do anything about them.
Do you apply those same principles to your own speech when it comes to talking about Asians or Muslims or other communities?
Sarah, I think you better rephrase that, because I don't talk about any hate with regards to them. If I speak of anything to do with immigration, it's on factual basis, so I don't believe it's hate speech. So so I think you should rephrase that.
Well, I was asking if those principles apply to your speech, not describing yours as hate speech,
which
yes
speech,
or no.
Sally?
To your comments.
Where have I actually referred to hate speech or hate for any group of organisation?
No.
Again, I've always called is about is for equality for all Australians. If I question about immigration or where people come from this country, it's because I want to see a country that's not divided with different views or different cultures, different laws, and I will stand my ground there.
And that is an extended interview with One Nation leader Pauline Hanson speaking to Sally Sarah on Radio National Breakfast. So picking up from where Pauline Hanson left off, our political correspondent Melissa Clark came on straight after for her analysis.
I think there was something quite notable in what Pauline Hanson said and is reflected in that polling that shows One Nation is trusted on the issue of immigration. And we heard Pauline Hanson say, people realise I'm consistent with policy. And she also says that she's doing not what is good for people don't want what's good politicians to do, what's good for them to keep their jobs. Sorry, took me a bit to spit that out. But what she's pointing to is that whether you like or dislike what One Nation stand for, they have clear principles, and she feels that their party is being rewarded for that. And this is something that the coalition is grappling with too. And we're seeing that when it comes to net zero. We're seeing some Liberal MPs, and I think Melissa McIntosh is a good example of this, who's polled her electorate, has seen a shift, at least from those who've responded to the poll, and has reflected that in changing her own position on how the country should respond to this issue. Others like Andrew Hastie is a good example in the other camp, he's acknowledged that his ideas and positions might not be the most popular, but he believes that it's important that we stand, that the party stands by them. So the coalition is grappling around this issue of authenticity, but also popularity.
And Mel, I was asking also Pauline Hanson about neo-Nazis and hate speech, which she was saying there's no room for hate speech.
This is a bit of a live issue at the moment because Pauline Hanson is currently embroiled in a court case around this.
That's
right. She was found to have breached the Racial Discrimination Act for a tweet that she made to Senator Maureen Faruqi of the Greens, telling her to piss off back to Pakistan. Now, Pauline Hanson is in the middle of appealing that, so this is a live court matter that is being contested. So this idea of bounds of language and where those boundaries lie is certainly something that is a live question at the moment.
And that was some immediate analysis from Mel Clark there, and that is where we'll leave federal politics for today. We're going to end in Tasmania today, where the rock lobster fishing industry had just reopened for the season, when just hours later, it was forced to shut down. Why? Over concerns about antibiotics being used at nearby salmon farms. But the closure isn't because of concerns around Tasmanians eating contaminated lobster. It's due to strict rules from China. The rules include that no traces of antibiotics can be found in imported lobsters. We wanted to hear from the community, and someone who understands how they feel is Peter George. He is the independent for the state seat of Franklin, and here's what Sally asked him first.
Why this sudden move, this change to the opening of the rock lobster fisheries?
Well, there's a bit of a history to this. In very briefly, last summer there were mass mortalities. Well over a million fish died. And the first anyone heard about it was when fish fat and flesh was started washing up on people's beaches. The industry is battling warming waters, which are too warm really for raising salmon prolifically. And they have introduced a brand new, with permission from the federal government, they've introduced a brand new antibiotic called fluorphenicol. Now, they started using that as soon as the day after they got permission for doing it. And the problem with that is that with these diseased pens, of course, when you feed antibiotic-laced fish feed to your salmon, you can't contain it within the nets they're in, so it gets washed out. That means that fish consume it, wild fish consume it. So the concern is that within a certain amount of distance, there will be the lobsters will be eating what is left over from pellets and so on as it washes through. And therefore consuming or at least containing residue of antibiotics in them.
And just to be clear, these requirements for imports into China, are they genuine biosecurity rules, or is that anything left over from trade disputes at all?
No, it is that China bans any antibiotic residue in the flesh that comes from, at least from Tasmanian seafood, and presumably from other countries as well. No, that is simply a requirement. So what you've got is a sort of a two levels of health. Apparently, it's all right for Tasmanians and Australians to eat meat that has got remnants of antibiotics in it, but not good enough for the Chinese consumer.
What's the reaction been from those who are involved in the rock lobster industry, Peter?
Mostly astonishment, some anger, and a great deal of concern from any of the communities who live anywhere near these fish farms. Because, of course, the feeling is now that everything revolves around the multinationally owned salmon farms. But yet the wild fishers who are told not to fish within 3 kilometres of a diseased pen that's been treated with antibiotics, now the rock lobster fishers who have been told that they can't use what are fairly prolific grounds, is perplexity and a degree of outrage, to be honest with you. The fish farms down here, the government has already announced that the fish farms don't, or admitted the fish farms don't have their social licence anymore to operate in the way that they do.
What do you think is going to happen in the longer term here?
Well, in the very long term, these fish farms can't go on operating this way. They've either got to get out of our shallow waterways in one way or another. Either they'd have to go out to sea, which is probably fairly impossible. Eventually, they are going to have to move onto land, which is the sort of the move that's happening around the world. In the meantime, what the fish farms should be doing is reducing their stocking densities. I've advocated for as soon as summer comes along, they should be reducing their stocking densities by 50%, because that's why the disease tends to spread so rapidly.
What do you think about the way the Tasmanian government has handled this, Peter?
Honestly, both Labor and Liberal down here are supporters of the fish farms, but that's because, as we saw during the election campaign, they have become very corporatised. They tend to answer to the corporates rather than to the people who elect them. I was elected with a huge majority in Franklin, based on running against, running on people's concerns about the fish farms and trying to rein them in. I got the third highest vote in the state, pretty much based on that. Also, of course, the Macquarie Point Stadium, which continues to be causing controversy. But there is a very, very strong mood against the way that these fish farms operate, because they do it very quietly. They're completely opaque in their operations. And everybody knows that the regulator is not up to the job of actually holding them, to account.
Peter George there, the independent MP for the seat of Franklin in Tasmania, discussing this partial closure of the Tasmanian rock lobster fishing industry. That is the Breakfast Wrap for today. Thank you very much for listening to that extended interview with Pauline Hanson and all the other interviews from Sally Sarah. They were produced by the ABC Radio National Breakfast team, and the Breakfast Wrap was today produced by Louise Mylan. As always, you can get Radio National Breakfast live on the wireless from 5:30 a.m. every day. And then later on, the Breakfast Wrap, 11:30 on Radio National, and a little bit earlier on the ABC Listen app. I'm Luke Sidham-Dundon. We'll see you same time, same place tomorrow.